all to today's event. And I just want to, I'm Ron Cowan, I'm the program director for this year's Brain Awareness. Just want to highlight some upcoming Brain Awareness events. First of all, Brain Awareness is sponsored by the Middle Tennessee Neuroscience Chapter of the Society for Neuroscience and by the Vanderbilt Brain Institute. And some upcoming events are the Brain Awareness keynote is next week, and that will be Is There a Neuroanatomy of Schizophrenia? At March 15th in Wilson Hall at 4:10 p.m. And the lecturer will be Dr. Stefan Heckers, who is the new James G. Blakemore Chair and Professor in the Department of Psychiatry. Then the week after, we'll have Endorphin Stress and the Addictions by Mary Jean Creek from the Rockefeller University, and then followed by a talk on the national sleep debt, looking at the role of sleep in the epidemic of obesity. And that talk will be by Eve Van Carter, and that was at the Adventure Science Center. But something worth scheduling, and that's off campus. And then next year we'll have Brainstorm 2007, so you can mark your calendars for that. So today's lecture is co-sponsored by the Department of Psychiatry here at Vanderbilt and by the Vanderbilt Institute for Imaging Sciences. And the lecture today is on using brain scans to detect Alzheimer's disease. Our lecturer is Dr. John Chernansky, who's the Gregory B. Couch Professor of Psychiatry and Director of the Sylvia O'Conti Center for Neuroscience Research at Washington University in St. Louis. And just a brief introduction on Dr. Chernansky. It's a great honor to have him here. Dr. Chernansky received his bachelor's degree at Northwestern University, then went on to New York University for his medical training. After that, he went across the continent to do internship and residency at Stanford in psychiatry. After that, he was chief resident at the VA there, and around 1990, relocated to Washington University in St. Louis, where he's been ever since. And really, for the past 25 years or so, Dr. Chernansky has really been doing critical research in dopamine systems, schizophrenia, and immediately ancillary and affiliated illnesses. Most recently, he's done some pioneering work in morphometric analysis of hippocampus, primarily, and other brain circuitry in schizophrenia, and has also turned those methods to Alzheimer's, which he spoke about earlier today and which he'll speak about here. So it's really great to have him here, and look forward to the talk.
Thank you. Just a brief technical interlude while we put the talk on. And now I must play with the lights. We'll just bring them down. How's that? That's better. Well, thank you, Ron, very much for the invitation to come and give this talk. It's a delight. I have the pleasure of coming here, I think, about once every 3 or 4 years. Maybe you forget that I've been here, and then I'm invited again or something like that. Today's talk, indeed, is on our efforts to apply the methods we've been developing for anatomical analysis of MR scans, magnetic resonance scans, to help in the efforts to detect early forms of Alzheimer's disease. As Ron mentioned, we developed these methods originally to help discover and characterize the anatomical abnormalities in the brains of patients with schizophrenia. And because those abnormalities are never all that profound, they're always subtle, very hard to see, very hard to discern, we spent a lot of effort making our methods very, very precise. And initially, there didn't seem to be much need to use these kinds of methods to see the changes in the brains of patients with Alzheimer's disease when the disease was fairly advanced. Because in those cases, it's quite evident when you look at an MR scan or a CT scan, you see ventricular enlargement, you see cortical atrophy, it's quite obvious. So you think, well, you don't really need precise quantification. But as you probably know, there's been increasing efforts recently to push the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease earlier and earlier in the process of the disease. That is to detect patients who have this disorder earlier and earlier in the progress of their disorder when these changes are very, very small and subtle. So the field really found itself back in the boat that we were familiar in terms of our efforts to study schizophrenia. And so we found that there was now a desire to apply the methods we developed to the study of early Alzheimer's disease. Now, what is dementia? And I think that it's important at first to distinguish the concept of dementia from the concept of Alzheimer's disease. Dementia is a clinical syndrome of cognitive deficit. And at Washington University, many years ago, Leonard Berg and John Morris developed an instrument called the Clinical Dementia Rating Scale, or the CDR. And this scale can be used by a clinician. It is not a neuropsychological test. It is a scale that a clinician could use in their office to grade the presence and severity of dementia in an individual. And the information is taken from the individual and also from their caregiver, or usually a spouse. It could be a child or somebody that they live with. And the amount of cognitive deficit is rated in 6 different categories or boxes. And the degree of that deficit is graded from none to questionable to mild, moderate, and severe. So from this, you can either you can ascertain that there is dementia present and you can gauge its severity. It's worthwhile pointing out that we give special treatment to the box, the memory box. And if an individual even has questionable memory impairment, we take that very seriously and still grade them overall as having an overall CDR score of 0.5, or in our hands, very mild dementia. You'll understand more what I mean in just a few slides. Now, what is Alzheimer's disease? Alzheimer's disease is a neuropathological progression of certain characteristics of the brain of a degenerative nature. The principal, there are 3 principal findings in patients with Alzheimer's disease. One is plaques made of an amyloid substance. And the amyloid substance in this case is composed of sheets of a peptide called A-beta, or beta amyloid. Tangles of neurofibrillary products, and in this particular case, these tangles are composed of the tangled neurofilaments of neuronal processes. And most of the protein in tangles is a protein called tau, the tau protein. Finally, it's presumed that the accumulation of these plaques, which are these big dark blobs, and these smaller tangles, if you accumulate enough of them, this leads in some way to neuronal damage and eventually the loss of whole neurons. And it is at the point of neuronal damage and loss that you begin to see dementia. So as you'll hear me argue, it's possible to have Alzheimer's disease without dementia. That is, you could have a very early form in which there's not enough progression of the disease that you would see neuronal damage and loss, and therefore you don't have dementia. And likewise, you could have another dementing disorder, and there are other dementing disorders, of course. Alzheimer's disease is the most common dementing disorder of late life, but vascular dementia occurs, dementia with Lewy bodies, frontotemporal dementia. There are other kinds of dementias that are not considered the same pathology as Alzheimer's disease. Now, in trying to understand or develop a way of looking at the anatomy of Alzheimer's disease, we have a terrific advantage in that the pathology of Alzheimer's disease is known, and the anatomical distribution of that pathology is also reasonably well understood. Now, what I've told you so far, and probably in your neuropathology courses, you've heard plaques and tangles usually put together in the same sentence very frequently with respect to Alzheimer's disease. But in fact, the distribution of plaques and tangles is not the same in the brains of patients with Alzheimer's disease. Neurofibrillary tangles tend to be most densely accumulated in the medial temporal lobe, especially in the hippocampus, subiculum, and the entorhinal cortex, which abuts the hippocampal formation proper. Whereas neuritic plaques, these amyloid plaques, tend to be more cortical in nature and are especially distributed in the posterior regions of the cerebral cortex. So these things are associated in Alzheimer's disease, but they are not always equally present in a given part of the brain. And there are certain parts of the brain where you see mostly tangles and other parts of the brain where you tend to see mostly plaques. And in both of these locations, ultimately, you still see neuronal damage and loss. Now, so here is the issue that I was alluding to at the very beginning of the talk. And again, we're using the CDR to rate the degree of clinical dementia. CDR 0.5 is very mild dementia, and I'll illustrate that a little bit more in the next slide. CDR 1 would be mild dementia. CDR 2 is moderate dementia. CDR 3 is severe dementia. Some centers have extended the CDR to CDRs 4 and 5, very severe. You can understand that CDR 3 individuals are really people who cannot live outside a nursing home. They require a tremendous amount of support. So most of the patients, subjects in our studies, are either CDR 0.5 or 1s. In fact, we have relatively few 2s and 3s. Now, again, the concept of the disease process of Alzheimer's is that it begins at some point in middle life. And for a period probably of about 10 years, it's progressing in the brain with gradual deposition of plaques and tangles without sufficient neuronal damage and loss so that it manifests itself as a clinical syndrome. And we call this, in our center, the preclinical phase of Alzheimer's disease. Then, at some stage, at this threshold for clinical detection, which we refer to as CDR 0.5, there are sufficient plaques and tangles to begin to trigger the loss of synapses and eventually neurons, and the disease becomes detectable. At about that same time, for the clinical progression, you begin to see deficits in performance on standard neuropsychological tests. Now again, going back to the CDR, for somebody to have a 0.5, they could either have a box score. Now remember, there are six categories, or what we call boxes. And you can have a score at any of the on any box of 0.5 up to 4.5 before you leave the 0.5 category. And so the only preference is, again, is given to the memory box, where even a single score of 0.5 in the memory box, we will call that patient having CDR 0.5. Now, just as an aside to people who are familiar with other ways of rating this early form of Alzheimer's disease, there's a phenomenon known called minimal cognitive impairment, or MCI. This is a terminology that's used widely throughout the United States, but at Washington University, we don't much like it. And the reason is that CDR 0.5 individuals, about half of them meet criteria for MCI, and about half are even milder than MCI. In our hands, the CDR 0.5 individual, if they die as a 0.5, and we have more than 50 of these individuals who died when they were CDR 0.5, 93% of them meet neuropathological criteria for Alzheimer's disease. So they have sufficient disease to be called Alzheimer's disease. And more than 90% of 0.5s, if you wait at least 5 years, will convert to having more advanced stages of dementia. So we don't see any reason for calling CDR 0.5 anything other than very mild dementia, the Alzheimer's type. It progresses to Alzheimer's disease, and if people die at that stage, they have pathological Alzheimer's disease. So to be blunt about it, we don't see the particular need for MCI as a at-risk category. In our hands, people who have MCI have early Alzheimer's disease, and you might as well say so. So if you then want to improve upon that, you want to push the boundary of being able to diagnose this illness back further in time to an earlier stage of the disorder, what is the best approach to doing that? Well, perhaps the most obvious approach is to use some sort of cognitive testing, some sort of special testing of cognitive abilities. After all, this is a cognitive deficit disorder. In our hands, standard neuropsychological tests do not seem to be any more sensitive than the CDR. And remember, the CDR really zooms in on a person's change in cognition over time. And in fact, we find that the caregivers, the spouses generally, are very sensitive to a person's change in function. Frankly, more sensitive than a psychometrician administering a neuropsychological battery. Now, that's not to say that there may not be tests of cognition that haven't yet been developed and tested that could improve upon that. And in fact, there are people in our center, David Belota, for example, who are working on that very task. But at least in our hands, standard neuropsychological tests are no better than the CDR. Now, there's a lot of interest in looking at CSF proteins. So I told you that the amyloid protein is composed of this peptide called A-beta. There are actually two major species of A-beta, this peptide, in our floating around in our brains and ultimately in our CSF. One is called A-beta 1 to 42. It has 42 amino acids. The other is A-beta 1 to 40. A-beta 1 to 42 is the minor of the two. It's about 10% of the A-beta we have floating around is A-beta 42. Most of it is A-beta 1 to 40. And A-beta 1 to 42 in various cell culture models and so forth seems to be especially toxic to neurons. So we tend to think of A-beta 1 to 42 as the toxic of the more toxic of the two species. So there have been a lot of studies measuring A-beta 1 to 42 in the CSF. And in fact, there is good evidence that A-beta 1 to 42 levels are decreased in the CSF of people who have very early forms of Alzheimer's disease. Why decreased? Because if you have Alzheimer's disease, that A-beta 1 to 42 is being deposited as plaques, and it's not getting out into the CSF. If you want the A-beta in the CSF, that's how we get rid of it. That's how we rid our brains of this peptide. So that's presumably why the levels are decreased. Now, there's another peptide called tau, and tau is a constituent of those tangles that I showed you. And tau levels tend to go up in patients with Alzheimer's disease. And that's helpful, but it tends to go up as a function of the severity of the disease. So the more tangles you have, the more severe, the higher it goes. And it's not particularly elevated very early in the disease. So it doesn't seem to be a terribly good marker for early forms. There's a lot of work at our center now on proteomics, which is sort of it just went to sleep. I hope you haven't gone to sleep. Okay. It's sort of an exploratory way of looking for proteins we haven't yet discovered in the CSF of these patients. And David Holtzman in our center is working very hard on that. And when he finds one, you'll be the first to know. It is an exploratory approach. Now, as I said, our laboratory has focused on using measures of neuroanatomical structure, especially structures in the medial temporal lobe and posterior medial cortex. I'll show you a lot of data on that in just a minute. I will show you a little bit of a very exciting new technology, which actually involves the in vivo, in a living person, labeling of amyloid with a PET tracer, a positron emission tomography tracer, which is quite exciting. So where to look? Well, I showed you the distribution of plaques and tangles, and it's clearly a hot spot is the limbic system, or the limbic lobe, or the circuit of Papin's. And this includes the hippocampus proper, the parahippocampal gyrus, which includes the entorhinal cortex in its most medial section, and the cingulate gyrus, especially the posterior cingulate gyrus, seems to be an area where we see a lot of early plaque deposition. So we see a lot of tangles in hippocampus, and we see a lot of plaques, excuse me, in both posterior cingulate and parahippocampal gyrus. And obviously you know that these structures are not independent. They are synaptic or functionally connected. Okay. How do we look? When we began this work several years ago, the state of the art of that time was hand outlining of the structures of the brain of interest. You would sit down at a computer terminal and take out a mouse, and draw lines around the structures of interest. We wanted to go beyond that for two reasons. One was that the hand outlining business was incredibly boring. And generally, when one of our fellows completed a project, they left neuroscience as a field. So we thought it was too high on attrition, so we wanted something that was automated. We wanted to teach a computer to do the hard part of this. And we came up with a technique called high-dimensional brain mapping. And what this does is that we take a template image, which is an MR scan. It's a template. We call it the template. And in that template, we set somebody down. We very carefully outline the structures that we want to study. We draw the boundaries, the surfaces of those structures in the MR scan very, very carefully. But we only have to do it once. After that, we take a computer, and the computer basically transforms or deforms the template until it exactly assumes the appearance of a set of unknown target images. Okay, so if you take a template, and if you think of it as a map, And you take that map and you stretch it and you pull it and you kind of, like it's made of rubber, until it exactly overlays what it is you want to measure. And the map has everything drawn on it. As soon as it exactly takes on the appearance of your target, in a sense, you've measured everything in the target, because the map has all the measurements embedded in them. So that's how this works. And it has some fancy electrical engineering algorithms called fluid transformations. And I can explain if people want to hear more about that later. I didn't invent those. We worked with a group of biomedical engineers led by Mike Miller, who was generous enough to work with us and apply these algorithms. So using this technology, we are able to measure both the volume and the surface, or if you want, the contour of the surface of any given brain structure. And of course, as I said, we focused on hippocampus. And here's our first study comparing young people about age 30, elderly people who are non-demented, that's CDR0, and older people, same age, older people who have very mild dementia. And these are the volumes of the hippocampus on the left and the right, left and right, left and right. A couple of things. First of all, you see the right hippocampus is always a little bigger than the left. And we were talking about this in psychiatry, and I was really relieved to hear Dr. Hecker's agree with that idea, that the right is always bigger than the left. Some people say, oh, I don't think that's true, but Dr. Hecker's would be an expert, and I'm glad he agrees. And the other thing you notice is that the CDR0.5 people have substantially lower volumes than their same age controls or the young individuals. In fact, they even at the stage of very mild dementia, you've lost about 20% of the volume of the hippocampus. It's a substantial volume decrease. Between zeros and young people, that is people about 75 and people who are about 30, there's a slight loss of hippocampal volume. It doesn't quite meet statistical significance in this sample, but it's much smaller, and you see there's a lot more variability in the hippocampal volume as you grow older. Now, as I said, we can actually recreate the surface of any given brain structure using our tools. And what we've done here is recreate the surface of the hippocampus. This is the left and the right hippocampus. The left hippocampus isn't that much smaller. The reason it looks a lot smaller is that it's further away from you. We've taken this paired structure and swung the image around, tilted it around so that you can see this edge of the right hippocampus. And that's why we did it, because we wanted you to see that edge. And basically, what this shows is that not only is there a loss of volume, but the pattern of the loss of volume is very specific. It's really like a thumbprint that identifies that particular disorder. And what you see is a kind of a shrunken head. By the way, the hippocampus sort of has three parts, the head, the body, and this tail that kind of loops around. So the head looks like it's mostly blue. Areas of blue are areas that are shrunken inward. And the entire lateral edge seems to be, as you can see, colored blue. And this is just a different way of representing that. We can do some statistics on these kinds of measurements and actually classify patients, depending on whether they are non-demented or have very mild dementia. And we do pretty well. Combining our surface measurements and volume, we can correctly classify 15 out of 18 0.5s and 14 out of 18 CDR0s. Now, there was a little bit of volume loss as you grow older without dementia, but there was a very substantial shape change. In fact, what you see is that the tail goes down, the head goes down, but you see all this red in the middle, and that means that part of the structure is coming up. So what that, if you actually look at this in an animation, what you see is that the hippocampus has been flattened. It hasn't lost much in the way of volume, but it seems to be flatter than it does in a young person. Now, why that is, yes? That is a combination, okay, that's going to require a little explanation. We take the surface of the hippocampus and divide it into many thousands of points that we use as data points. And then we can represent the variation in shape change by looking at the principal components of the variation of those thousands of points. And we do that using basically principal components analysis within the population. Now, you take a combination of all the eigenvectors and you get a log likelihood statistic that tells you the likelihood of belonging to one group or another. So I didn't want it to sound too out there, but that's what that is. So it's just a measure of whether you you ought to be in this group or you ought to be in this group. And if, and for old versus young, there's almost, there is complete separation. For demented versus non-demented, there's pretty good separation, not complete separation. It's actually better when you combine volume in with the shape measurement. Now, we looked at that pattern, and we say, that doesn't look random. That looks like it has an anatomical basis. And in fact, if you, here's the hippocampus in sort of an exploded diagram of it, and you see the components of the hippocampus, the internal components, that is the corneal monus and the dentate gyrus, and this lateral edge is the CA1 subfield. That is a particular subfield of the hippocampus. And in fact, the CA1 wraps itself around the whole head. So this idea of the head being shrunken and the lateral edge is at least compatible with this, with the idea that the CA1 component of the hippocampus seems to be especially affected in early Alzheimer's. That's satisfying to us because the neuropathologists predicted it. They said you should find the most pronounced changes in the subiculum, which is underneath, and in the CA1 subfield. So then we thought, well, let's build an anatomical model and test it. And we did that by taking our template scan, and we went through that template scan slice by slice and outlined this time not just the hippocampus in its entirety, but every cellular component of the hippocampus. The dentate gyrus, CA4, 3, 2, or I should say 4, 3, 2, 1, and this is subiculum. And then what we did was we built a model of the surface of the hippocampus showing where those components reached that surface. So areas where you see magenta is the portion of the surface that overlies the CA1 subfield, where you see light blue is the portion of the surface that overlies the subiculum, and the rest of the components are rather buried inside and they peak out just on the superior surface. So we were able to, in essence, create three surfaces or three zones on the surface by doing this kind of substructural segmentation. Then we sought to replicate it, our initial finding, in a completely different sample of subjects. So there's no overlap here. We had 49 individuals with very mild dementia and 86 healthy non-demented controls, all about 75 years of age. In this case, we now are looking at the hippocampus not just as a single structure, but dividing its surface into three zones that correspond to underlying cellular subfields. We used our same tool, high-dimensional brain mapping, to match the template to the target scans. And we measured the displacement of the surface in those three zones in the patients against the average surface in the control of that same patch. And we did some careful reliability measurements to assure us that what we were measuring by our automated method was the same as what we would pick up if we'd done everything by hand. Of course, if we'd done everything by hand in more than 100 subjects, we'd still be doing it. We wouldn't be standing here talking about it. So here are the basic findings of this replication study. Again, hippocampal volume is substantially decreased in people with very mild Alzheimer's disease, about 20% on the whole. And it seems to be bilateral. You see the right is bigger than the left in both groups. In both groups, left, left, right, right, it's decreased. Then when you divide the three zones, you see a decrease in the lateral zone. That's the CA1, what I called before the CA1 zone. That's inwardly deformed, if you will. And the inferior medial zone, which is the subiculum, is also decreased. And the third zone, the control zone, is not decreased. So it does suggest, in fact, that there's a particular pattern. And again, here's the map of the difference between the patients with dementia and the normal, healthy, aged individuals. And you can see these patches of blue indicate where on the surface of the hippocampus there is deformity. So basically, what I'm showing you is that not only can we measure the overall sizes of things, but we can show these patterns that seem to be specific to certain diseases.
Could you say something about how tightly selected the subjects were going into the analysis in the sense of ethnicity? Obviously, age is a factor, but are there other things that are keeping the variability somewhat? It's spread, but maybe
Well, it's fair to say this is not a community sample of individuals. So they are matched for education, you know, the demented and the non-demented. In fact, many of the demented patients used to be non-demented. This is, we have a very large cohort of elderly individuals who oftentimes sign up as healthy elderly controls. And then as they grow older, many of them will convert and have various stages of dementia. So they're drawn from the same community, but they are volunteers and they're very altruistic. This is not a sort of an epidemiological sample. We're very careful to screen out medical illnesses like stroke, brain injury, epilepsy, and so forth that would clearly obscure things. There are smokers in the group. We do code the amount of drinking that they do. We haven't looked at that as carefully as I would like. But I don't think that they're heavily screened. They are screened to rule out depression. So everybody gets a depression assessment, but if they meet sort of DSM-4 syndromal criteria for major depressive disorder, they're not included. And the reason for that is that the transition from non-demented to demented is very hard to decide in somebody who's acutely depressed. You can't decide. So they obscure that the assessment. It's not that we necessarily... We could worry about what it does to the brain, but it's more that it obscures the clinical assessment. So they are a population of volunteers.
And were we looking at gender match?
They tend to be about 60% women and about 40% men. And as they grow older in age, it tends to be more and more women, as you might expect. But the groups, our groups, are generally well matched for gender as well as age. I will say that men tend to have bigger heads, bigger brains. They're taller. You know, their habitus is larger. But the contour, and in fact, this is a good argument for measuring the surface contour of things, is that that's not affected by gender. The hippocampus looks the same in a man and a woman. Everything is just a little bigger in a man. But apparently, we don't use much of that extra capacity, as far as I can tell. We do tend to see cohort effects, I will say that as well, just thinking about potential confounds. So the older people are, the smaller their heads, just because of nutritional differences. So for example, our 30-year-olds are taller, they have bigger heads, bigger everything compared to our 80-year-olds. We do tend to covary everything for the intracranial volume, because that doesn't change. It's a good measure of how big the brain ever was. As far as we understand it. So that's another way you can get rid of problems with regard to gender differences or age cohort differences. So let's move on to a cortical area. What about measuring one of those pieces of cortex? Now in the cortex, we have a different problem. We treat the hippocampus rather unfairly, I suppose, as a blob of gray matter. We don't try to distinguish gray matter, white matter. We just treat it as a blob of gray matter. But in the cortex, of course, you simply can't do that. The cortex is a carpet, and it has a contour. It has an edge between the gray matter and the white matter, and it has boundaries of any particular portion of it, of the gyrus, if you will. So it's a much more complicated thing, and it was the second kind of toolkit we developed. And we called this method labeled cortical mantle depth mapping. And the goal of this tool, here's the cingulate gyrus, anterior and posterior, was to measure gray matter volume, but also thickness, surface area, and ultimately contouring of the cortical mantle in a given part of the cortex. Oops. We start by doing hand segmentations of a learning set, where somebody goes through about, actually for this we went through about 10 brains, and very laboriously sort of colored the pixels or colored the elements that compose the gray matter of the anterior cingulate gyrus and the posterior cingulate gyrus. We then do a rather conventional histogram-based, if you don't know what this means, you want to ask me later, it's okay, sort of a histogram-based tissue classification, somewhat guided by that manual segmentation. And then what we do is we identify the boundary between white and gray matter. That's our surface of reference. So we want to measure thickness, depth in reference to something, and we have to pick a surface. And there are two choices. There's the gray matter, the surface between gray matter and CSF, and there's the surface between gray matter and white matter. Which would you pick? Which do you think is the better surface to use as a reference surface? Most people intuitively say, well, why don't you pick the surface between gray matter and CSF? You can see it. You know, it's right there. It's nice and sharp. Actually, it's not a good surface to measure because in a healthy brain, you probably know that the brain is, you know, folded. The cortex is highly folded, and there's a lot of cortex buried in these folds. And unless your MR scan is extremely good, there's a lot of lost surface buried in these folds of the cortex. So it's very hard, in fact, to see the CSF gray matter boundary. You'd think it would be easy, but that's because you're only looking at part of it when you hold the brain like this. You can't see the parts that are buried. So we used the gray-white surface, and that's because it never abuts. It's always well distinguished, one gyrus from another. And this is a representation from a real person of their gray-white surface of the cingulate, anterior to posterior. Then you have to draw the line between what's cingulate and what's everything else in the brain. And we developed our engineers developed another tool for that called the sulco mapping tool. And it's a very clever tool. What it does is it finds you give it a beginning point and an ending point. And you sometimes have to help it by giving it way station points, just like on an autopilot. And what it does basically is it fills in everything else by finding the most energy efficient pathway between the beginning and the end. And what does it mean to be energy efficient? There's a great metaphor for this. If you were to stand at the top of a mountain with a giant bucket of water, and you were to pour the bucket of water down the mountain, the water would find not the most direct path to the bottom, it would find the most energy efficient path to the bottom. It would be as direct as possible, but if it had to turn corners to go around trees and so forth, it would. And that's what this tool does. It finds the most energy efficient sulcal gully. And we've verified in monkeys that this is highly accurate for defining a sulcal boundary. So this was a nice advantage. So now we have a piece of cortex, we have its edges defined, we have a surface that's the gray matter, white matter surface. Now we want to measure the gray matter. How do we do it? We do it probabilistically. So we start as though you're standing on the gray matter surface, gray-white surface, and you're walking to the dura. You're walking through the gray matter to the dura, and you're estimating the probability of encountering gray matter. So it very quickly goes up. And then as you get closer and closer to CSF, it goes down. Here's the probability of getting to CSF. You know, you don't have much for a while, and then you encounter some CSF voxels, and here's white matter. You know, in a given place, you'll quickly run out of white matter if you're standing at the surface. So we do this probabilistically. Then what we do is we take that probability profile. Here's for gray matter alone, the distance from the cortical surface. The area underneath it is the volume of the gray matter. Right? Once you've gotten to the end and you've accounted for all the gray matter, that's its volume. We do a cumulative profile till we've accounted for 100% of the gray matter voxels, and then what we do is we measure a thickness by taking some relatively arbitrary percent of the thickness of the structure. Namely, we tend to use the 50th percentile of the median, and at that point, we say that's the median thickness of the piece of cortex, and we multiply by 2, and that's the average thickness. So we estimate volume, surface area, and thickness independently and probabilistically. Doing this, again, comparing CDR1s, these are mildly demented, 0.5s, non-demented healthy elderly people, and young controls, we can then look at the anterior, posterior cingulate gyrus, left and right. What we find is that we find sort of a graded loss of gray matter volume in the posterior compartments of the cingulate gyrus on both left and right. We see something similar in the anterior, but it's really not present until you get to CDR1 on the left side and minimally present on the right. So there does seem to be, as the pathologist would have predicted, more of a gross change in the cingulate gyrus in the posterior compartment. This idea that the plaques are being are accumulating in the posterior part of the cortex, and therefore we tend to see it more there. Thickness tends to follow, so we tend to see in the posterior compartment of the cingulate gyrus, we see very highly significant differences in these thicknesses. And here's a couple of these cumulative plots, so you can see the difference. The light green being normal individuals, the light green being the demented individuals and everybody else. So they reach their 50th percentile in a shorter distance, that is, they have a thinner cortex. I don't want to belabor the details. I'm happy to talk about it later. We've now very recently applied this to the perihippocampal gyrus, and again, also find for gray matter volume evidence in very mildly demented individuals and mildly demented individuals, loss of gray matter volume, but not in elderly normals. But here, for cortical thickness, for the first time, we see evidence of a decrease in cortical thickness in the perihippocampal gyrus, even in 75-year-olds who don't seem to be demented at all. Now, again, the pathologist would say that in this part of the cortex would be the earliest possibility of detecting cortical damage, and we may be seeing that here, or you may be seeing an age-related change in the particular part of the cortex. This is very new work and not yet published. So I want to end by talking about one or two other studies, sort of, if you will, proof of concept studies. Would we be able to detect or predict the onset of dementia in people who are not at all demented now? So we have an opportunity, or we had an opportunity to do this. We had 49 individuals who got their MR scans when they were not at all demented. They were CDR zeros. And as I think I've convinced you, I hope I've convinced you, if in our center we say you're not demented, you really are not demented. If there's any whiff of it, you'll be labeled as a CDR 0.5. Over a period of about 3 years, 14 of these individuals actually converted and became very mildly demented. So we had about 50 to start with, and about 30% of that cohort over a period of 3 years developed very mild dementia. This is the survival curve, sort of showing that. And then what we did is we did a Cox proportional hazard model trying to determine which anatomical variable would predict the risk of conversion. We entered all our volume variables, and we found that the left hippocampal volume predicted the risk, or the predicted conversion from CDR 0 to CDR 0.5. And when we did our surface-based measures, we find, again, that the left CA1 zone also predicted. When we entered both the volume and the shape into one analysis, we did pick the surface measure as the more powerful of the two predictors. I wouldn't get too excited about thinking it's going on only on the left side. The right side measures were just behind it, just behind them, and they too would have been considered significant predictors. But the left-sided measures were better predictors, and they were so highly intercorrelated the model would only take one. So that's the nature of these kinds of regression models. If you look at the volumes, although the volume difference between converters and non-converters doesn't quite meet statistical significance, I think the left hippocampus is 11% smaller in people who are eventually going to convert to being demented compared to those who don't, at least within 3 years. And the right hippocampus, again, was in the same direction, less of a difference, 6% smaller in the converters versus the non-converters. So this would really suggest that you can begin to detect these changes, at least in the hippocampus, at a point when nobody's demented, but within 3 years, somebody will become demented. And that's really the ultimate goal of any kind of biomarker, is that it should be better than any kind of clinical instrument or even a cognitive test, because ideally you'd like to detect and treat these disorders when people are still entirely cognitively normal. And that's the ultimate goal of any kind of early detection system, I suppose. And this, again, is the picture of the converters compared to the non-converters. And you see these patches of blue along the lateral edge and in the head. Again, the same kind of picture we saw in people who were very mildly demented but less severe. It just seems to be so. So a summary of our findings to date. So for hippocampus, again, thinking about this limbic system as a group of structures, we find evidence of smaller volumes. and patterns of shape change or shape deformation that are consistent with damage to the CA1 and subiculum of the hippocampus. We find them in patients with very mild dementia. We also find similar changes, although of smaller magnitude, in people who are non-demented, completely non-demented, but who later manifest very mild dementia. In the cingulate gyrus, we also find evidence of smaller volumes and thinning of the cortex in patients with very mild dementia, and some suggestion that there's more prominent involvement of the posterior component, that is, the rear part of the cingulate gyrus. In the parahippocampal gyrus, which includes the entorhinal cortex, smaller volumes and cortical thinning again are present, with some suggestion that there may be some measurable amount of thinning, even in people who are 75 but not at all demented. Whoops. What happened there? I didn't think I'd turn those off. Did you not pay your electric bills or something? The lights say they're on. No, I tried. I tapped that. I thought this. Is that on? All right. We just had to tap it again. I'm not quite done. Maybe you want me to be done. Maybe somebody said, that's enough. Turn the lights off. Maybe you'll go home. So we have now a new set of questions that we're very interested to pursue. Can we do better by combining information about these anatomical structures across different structures, put all the stuff together and create one measure, one composite measure that says this person has an anatomy that fits with early Alzheimer's or not? We're working on ways to do that. It's not quite so easy to do that, but we're working on approaches to do that. What is the relationship between changes in neuronal architecture, which presumably are the basis of these changes in morphology, the neuropathology that's related to them, and ultimately the state of dementia? What exactly are those relationships? Believe it or not, it's still relatively poorly understood. Well, somebody really wants me to stop. Can you fix this? Well, I'm going to keep talking.
Do you want the lights down?
Huh? Well, we need the projector back on.
Come back on.
It's not on yet. You don't just do this to me, do you?
No. The lights are working.
The lights are working. Well, I'll tell you what, let me try to just finish, because it's almost 5 o'clock anyway.
Okay.
So let me see if I can just summarize what I was going to show you, just the last couple of slides. So it seems our state of knowledge at the present time is that goes something like this. As we grow older, there seems to be a age-dependent accumulation of these tangles throughout the brain, especially in medial temporal lobes, but it's very slow, and the slope of it is very gradual. So we can live a long time with a few tangles in our head. It seems, however, that when plaques begin to appear, which is probably more of the pathology of Alzheimer's, two things begin to happen. One is plaques begin to appear, but more importantly, the rate at which tangles are deposited seems to accelerate greatly. So we start sort of a shift in that slope, and people start to lay down tangles much more rapidly once there are some plaques in the neighborhood. Finally, it seems as though, as best we can tell, that you don't tend to see cognitive losses until you see frank morphological change or until you see significant synaptic loss and ultimately neuronal loss. And the earliest places to find that seems to be in the entorhinal cortex and the hippocampus, especially in the CA1 subfield. So there is still this issue of exactly what is it? You know, what is it that, power off? I don't know. You got me. You know, what is it that causes neuronal degeneration in Alzheimer's disease? Is it the physical presence of the plaque? Is it the sort of the some level of the A beta peptide? You know, these peptides are toxic. They don't have to be in a plaque. If they're just floating around, you might imagine that they could kill neurons that way. What I was going to show you is that a new technology in our center is PIB labeling. This is a dye that actually you can inject by vein, goes into the head, crosses the blood-brain barrier, and labels amyloid plaques. And in about 30% of non-demented people around the age of 75, they will have labeling that makes it look as though they have Alzheimer's disease. Now, that figure of about 25 or 30% could be correct in the sense that when CDR0, or non-demented people, die at age of 75, about 20 to 25% of them meet neuropathological criteria for Alzheimer's disease, so the numbers sort of fit. So one of our more recent projects is to combine amyloid imaging with our morphometry to determine what is the relationship between the laying down of plaques and the gradual destruction and loss of neurons and the deformation of structures. And I think I'll just stop there because I can't show you the last slide or two. You got me. I don't know. There's something very weird going on around. So I'll just stop and try to answer your questions. Yes?
Do you mind a question while we have this here? The 30% you just mentioned, I think I remember correctly.